much. This is joint work with a couple of former students, but they have to work, so they sent me here. Sorry about that. User-based network services. So the issue here that we're trying to get is how do you deploy secure network services easily? And so in order to deploy these network services, the service has to be able to authenticate users to ensure that only intended users access the service, encrypt communications to prevent eavesdropping and active attacks against the communication channel, and to authorize the services and customize them based on the user that is been authenticated. And services that provide all three of the above requirements are called user-based network services. UBNS services include, got a cold standing out, waiting to get into a haunted house at Halloween. So I'm from Chicago, so, they should have Halloween a couple of months earlier in Chicago. At any rate, UBNS services include mail, calendar, and source repositories. In each of these cases, different users have different privileges. For example, I can only access my mail, but hopefully not yours. The UBNS service is the most challenging of these network services to implement. Our goal is to be able to implement them easily, provide strong protections, and reduce the opportunity for security holes that so often creep into security critical components. So I don't like password authentication very much. The first speaker had a very nice paper on this, and there are ways, obviously, of improving password-based authentication. But I think in the long run, and I'm a professor, remember, I don't have systems that I have to worry about day to day. In the long run, I think we should switch over to public key cryptography, which doesn't require these kinds of intermediaries, the disclosure of secrets to various people. So I prefer cryptographic-based authentication using public key. Symmetric encryption is needed to efficiently prevent passive and active attackers from interfering with packets. And we have to authorize users. So we have a lot of different things that we need to deal with that, with this. In the traditional Unix stack for dealing with these things, we have GSS API, generic security services, transports authentication tokens between client and server, PAM, pluggable authentication modules, used to select the authentication mechanisms for users, and network services switch access where the authentication information databases. The above services are implemented in libraries, and since libraries share address space with the applications, failure in the applications can bypass library protections or steal the secrets, like secret keys, out of libraries. And so we need a separate address space to provide privilege separation. And the traditional software stacks are also hard to use. They're hard to use and security sensitive. And when you mix that together, you get a really, really bad outcome, typically. So how difficult is it to do UBNS? Well, Dovecot is an IMAP POP server. We happen to use it in my lab before we looked at it, anything internally, so it wasn't for the purpose of this talk that we started using it. The author of Dovecot has a 1,000 euro, not dollars, euro, security guarantee that if you find a security hole in Dovecot, you get the money. The last time I looked, which may not be up to date, nobody had collected that. He implemented Dovecot using four different process types for privilege separation. Some 37% of the IMAP server, 9,307 lines of code, are just for implementing authentication and encryption. And that line count doesn't include any external libraries like OpenSSL, and which add much, much more to the entire line count. The authorization is enforced by the OS, so of course it doesn't include that. But enforcing the authorization by the OS is a good thing, because you know how the OS works. To figure out how the application works, you have to go look at the application source code, or you could just believe the documentation that comes with the application. It's up to you. And this was implemented by a security expert, because otherwise he wouldn't agree to pay 1,000 euros. If he found a security hole in it, he'd be a fool. So with the cool toolkit we've developed, you need only a single application service process. Only a handful of lines of code are needed in that application server. Privilege separation is provided, so it's a more secure environment. And it's easier to use in terms of to implement. So I'm going to talk about this SSH-based UBNS toolkit. So we wanted to provide a toolkit which doesn't require any knowledge of cryptographic implementations and esoteric libraries, makes maximum use of OS facilities, isolates security critical UBNS functionality from service logic, not just into different libraries, but completely into different address spaces, and doesn't require kernel modifications, because we had done an earlier version of this that did require kernel modifications, and a lot of people don't want to modify their kernel so that they can run some sort of network security stack. It's based on SSH, but SSH doesn't, the current version of SSH doesn't support UBNS. It does support something called port forwarding, which enables a protected link between two hosts, and it authenticates that link. I'll show you a little bit more details in the next slide. But it doesn't authenticate individual users to the services. It's just at the host level. So we've added code to SSH to support UBNS, thus creating an SSH-based toolkit, which can be easily used on both the client and server side. And in particular, our goal was to support different client OSs. We wanted to be agnostic about that and have absolutely no changes to the client application. So here's a traditional SSH port forwarding. SSH assures that the client side SSH, the server side SSHD, are both being run by the same user. That information is tunneled, but it doesn't say anything about the client there. That could be owned by a different user, and the service could be owned by yet another user. And so traditional SSH port forwarding is not an end-to-end property. Here's SSH UBNS. Now the client, the server, both ends of the SSH tunnel are owned by the same user, and the service thus knows who the user is at the other end. So it looks just like port forwarding. We could do, here's the SSH port forwarding from port 3000 on the local host to port 25 on the remote host, example.com. It could be that your name on the local host is DP and your name on the remote host is Dave. And so you can also give a name in there. Dave@example.com is the only difference between those two lines. And to get SSUBNS with different names, same name, it looks the same except we add a dash U to there. And so this difference in name is convenient because you have different systems with different namespaces. We're talking about having completely different administrators, not one umbrella, as is, for example, assumed in Kerberos, where you have a single global namespace. So the challenge is, in designing SSH UBNS, avoid changing client-side applications, make client-side OS independent, ensure client and SSH are owned by the same user, and ensure service and SSHD are owned by the same user, provide privilege separation, and provide high performance, particularly on the server side. On the client side, we typically have a lot of cycles, and we don't do much of this anyway, so it's not a big deal there. So we made three changes to support SSH. We added this UBNS mode to client and server on SSH. That means on SSH and SSH daemon. We added in a new UBNS super server in the tradition of INetD, and then you need a few trivial server modifications per server. They basically have to do with separating out the stuff that comes before accept from accept and changing the name of accept to accept by UBNS. Client-side changes. So we want to ensure the client and SSH have the same owner, and so we need to, in order to do that, we need to check the owner at the other end of a local TCP/IP connection. Now, there's no operating system way of doing this if the TCP connection is not local, so that's an important attribute. And each OS has a mechanism to support this. In Linux and other Unix variants, you have LSOF. On Windows, you have open ports, which can tell, given one end of a TCP connection, what the other end is connected to. For maximum capability, we wanted to use TCP/IP between client and service. And it is, as I said, relatively slow on the client side because LSOF is implemented in this really weird way. It's different on different architectures, and some of them are like really, really slow. I don't know if there's some way we could have speeded it up by setting flags and trying out all different kinds of things, or whether that was sort of inherent. The Mac version seemed particularly slow for some reason. I don't know, maybe somebody can tell me about that. So, but that's the client side. It doesn't matter if it's slow there. We're only going to set up a few of these things, and then we're off to the races. Now, UNetD is a super server, so we have to define the various services. So we define that with a port or a service name, a group, the set of users who are authorized to do it, star for concurrence server, and args is the arguments to be passed to the executable. Here is the way UNetD builds its set of processes. It starts out with a single UNetD running as root, reads through the configuration file, spins off a separate process for every service in the configuration file, and that waits for new configurations. In the case of POP3, the middle one here, when we show what happens as new user requests come in, different processes are spawned for each of the users that arrive, and communication is performed with the users. So the top two rows of this diagram are the UNetD code, and then what we do is we do, to get the bottom row, we do a fork, a set UID, and an exec to get the per user service, and then we have to make sure that these things at the bottom line up with the corresponding SSHD run under the same user as the POP3 user. So here's how we ensure that it's the same user. SSH binds to a port, then it connects to UNetD POP3 using a Unix socket, which enables a trivial check of ownership. We're assuming that the server is a Unix system or a Linux system. SSHD sends the bind value, sends its bind value to UNetD/POP3. UNetD POP3 creates POP3 with fork set UID exec, sending the bind value. And now SSHD connects to POP3 using the bound port over TCP/IP. POP3U authenticates by checking the source port. And so it's a very fast check on the service side. How long have I been talking? How many days? 15 minutes. All right, I just wanted whether to go through this horrific diagram, but if everybody starts walking out, I'll speed through it. And yeah, the question wasn't about my time, it was about your patience. So the client application connects to SSHD on the client. There's these little numbers, I don't know if you can see them. SSHD on the client connects to SSHD on the server, and SSHD checks the ownership. SSHD then binds to a port and sends that port to UNETD POP3. It sends that to the port using a Unix domain socket, so UNETD can check the owner of that socket. If that owner is not in the group of allowed users for the POP3 service, it sends a failure message back to SSHDU. Otherwise, if a star has been in the configuration file, then UNETD POP3 does the following things. It creates a TCP/IP listening socket for the process to be forked. The service provider is forked and exec. You can also set UID as, and the user ID is changed. That UID is changed in between the fork and the exec. And then the service executable, I'm sorry, I got an extra exec in that slide, I'm sorry. It's exec, set UID, I'm sorry, forked, set UID, exec. Sorry for the confusion. The UNETD process replies back to SSHD with the port number, and now SSHD, that bottom link, connects directly up to POP3. POP3 checks the port number it's coming on. Since SSHD bound to that port number, nobody else can use it for that connection, and so we've authenticated between SSHD and POP3. And those of you who know SSHD, I've left out a slew of processes. There's a whole bunch of things in SSHD is creating and spinning off processes like crazy for reasons of privilege separation, et cetera. But this is accurate for the part that it does show. Performance. So this was done on a dual-core processor. Takes about 4 milliseconds on the client side. We were able to run about 295 connections per second on the server side. And the way we did that is we did 100 POP connections for 10 users, and so it's 1,000 total connections. The dominant cost in all of this is the public key cryptography in SSH. All the rest of the stuff is noise. I didn't measure what percentage it was. Related work. Privilege separation of dividing things so that each process has the minimum number of privileges, a well-studied area. It was studied for OpenSSH because OpenSSH had bugs in its design that they sought to avoid in the future by using privilege separation. There's been a number of kernel-based services in order to provide cleaner authentication. Authnet was the first UBNS one. There's Plan 9 had a capability-based authentication system. And distributed firewalls and Keynote did things similar, but it wasn't quite UBNS. It didn't get the full linkage end-to-end. There was a web server designed for UBNS, but the UBNS protocol there or relied on web cookies. It wasn't generalizable to other protocols. You can use Kerberos for symmetric key. The problem with Kerberos is it doesn't scale up to the internet. It assumes you've got one single naming, or it doesn't scale well. And but Kerberos is nice. It just doesn't do certain things. SSH UBNS is an easy to use toolkit for creating user-based network services. It provides a mechanism for implementing these services with no changes to the client applications. It requires minimum change to the application services. UNetD implements authentication, super service, and privilege separation, thus providing for very secure architecture. And SSH UBNS uses BIND and Unix domain sockets to inexpensively authenticate between SSHD and the user-based network service. Thank you.
You mentioned scaling issues with using Kerberos. Are you kind of just pushing them into a different realm with now having to deal with scaling issues with your SSH keys?
There are issues with SSH keys for sure, and but the underlying cryptography on which SSH is built, the asymmetric or public key cryptography, enables things to be inherently scaled to much larger degrees.
I'll come and chat afterwards. We've had some good experience using a combination of Kerberized SSH with other keys, and I think a hybrid approach would be even better.
Okay, look forward to that.
Hi, it sounds to me like it's sort of tackling the same sort of question or the same problem that AuthPF from the OpenBSD project does. And I'm just wondering, what are the differences? What are the advantages? What am I missing in your approach?
I'm sorry, I don't know AuthPF.
Oh, fair enough. AuthPF is a shell. You install it on an OpenBSD firewall. People log in through SSH. And AuthPF will then load a different set of firewall rules that will sort of apply to that person's IP address. Now we allow that IP address to pop, SMTP, what have you.
Okay, so that sounds very similar to distributed firewalls. I don't know if you've seen that work, so it sounds like an implementation of that. And the difference is that the, if I understand that correctly, the user ID, the username doesn't go all the way to the end process. It just goes to the, it's to the host boundary. Thank you.
Sorry, I wasn't here for the whole thing, but I misjudged when you were going to start, so I came in late. It sounds like this might be possible to use to build tunnels that automatically launch when connected to on a local machine. Is that the case?
You mean using auto SSH or something like that?
Not even sure. I mean, it's like leave a connection on your local machine open on, say, port 1025, and as soon as the machine tries to connect to it, you know, like your mail server tries, your local mail client tries to connect to it to send email, have it automatically connect to the my office's SSH server.
And yeah, I imagine that would be the way you'd prefer to work it.
Right.
So I agree, that's a good point.
Not so much leave the tunnel running all the time, but just launch it upon talking to the SSH, local SSH port, and then build the tunnel and set up the actual tunnel through that. Does that make sense?
Well, so you need to decide if... I think I missed something.
I'll talk to you later.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.